It's 7:30 on this West Virginia morning. I'm Beth Voorhees. Noted jazz pianist Bob Thompson knows he can't go too far with Christmas music.
You have to be very careful when you're dealing with Christmas music, because this is music that belongs to everybody, and people know this music, and they, you know, it's special to them, so you can't take it too far.
The story coming up on this West Virginia morning. The governor's education reform bill passed through the legislature and was signed into law earlier this year. That bill was seen as a major overhaul to the state's public education system, which critics said was failing West Virginia students. The law was only meant to be the first step in reform. During interim sessions, lawmakers have been continually hearing about ways the Department of Education is trying to improve student achievement with new or updated programs that affect all ages. Ashton Mara has more.
It has become the hot topic at the department right now.
Assistant State Superintendent Kathy D'Antoni is referring to career exploration in middle schools, an initiative the governor's bill worked to expand, giving middle schoolers more opportunities to explore the types of careers available to them. She told a legislative education committee the department is expanding their career aptitude testing for eighth graders to include more modules, helping them figure out not just what careers they may have an interest in, but also what path they would need to take to get there.
There's one particular module that's pretty revealing for students. It's called Budget Your Life, and they ask the students to go in and determine what it is that they want to do after high school, what kind of house they want to live in, what kind of car they want to do. And it generates a report that says, if this is what you want when you graduate from high school, here are the jobs that provide that type of salary to get you to where you want to be. So it's very eye-opening to a lot of students.
D'Antoni works closely with career and technical education centers across the state that give high school students access to classes to get a jump start on a vocational career. 21 of these centers have chosen to take part in a new program created by the department called Simulated Workplaces. These workplaces allow students to experience the real world firsthand by making them clock in and out every day as they, as a class, create a business and try to increase its net worth. Part of the program includes random drug testing, but students can also choose to go through a mandatory drug testing process. Students who successfully complete that path are given a certificate to attach to their resume after graduation, so possible employers can have confidence the students aren't using drugs.
It gives me great pleasure to say that over 80% of our seniors are opting for mandatory drug testing,
which D'Antoni says is helping provide the drug-free workforce West Virginia employers want, but are currently having trouble finding. But the superintendent says there are some portions of the governor's bill the department hasn't been able to fully implement. Not yet. For example, D'Antoni says high schools and career and technical colleges are supposed to be working together to create clear pathways for students from vocational programs in high schools to two-year degrees at the higher ed institutions through the creation of a new consortium. She says talks are still only in the early stages to create that consortium.
The situation is we've had two systems that grew in isolation of each other. And we've come to a point in our economy where the workforce, the future of West Virginia, is dependent upon those two systems interfacing and talking to each other.
She shared her personal opinion that the legislature needs to do more to hold the two systems accountable and get them motivated.
We are sitting in an exciting time in West Virginia of economic opportunity. We have a window that we could just change the face of West Virginia. But we have to get our ducks in a row, and our educational systems need to be very closely attached to not each other, but also with workforce, with economic development. This has to happen, and these difficult conversations need to take place for us to be successful.
Lawmakers expect many of these issues to come up during the legislative session that begins in early January. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Ashton Mara in Charleston.
A professor of geriatrics at the Marshall University School of Medicine recently published an article that shows the elderly struggle when the power is out. Clark Davis takes a closer look at a problem that can be prevalent during the winter months.
Dr. Shirley M. Nitsch is a professor of geriatrics in the Department of Internal Medicine at the Joan C. Edwards School of Medicine. She, along with a team of researchers, just published an article on the effects of prolonged power outages on the healthcare of elderly patients. The study was published last month in the peer-reviewed journal Clinical Geriatrics. Nitsch says, although the premise seems obvious, many times elderly and especially bedridden elderly aren't ready for the outages.
If the question is, are you prepared for a power outage or some kind of a weather disaster, everybody says, sure we are. But if you ask specific questions, do you have a week's worth of your medications? Would you evacuate if you were told to do so? Would you know where to go if you were asked to evacuate? You find out that's not 100%. They are not really ready.
And she says that's the scary part for those providing care to geriatric patients. The study highlighted two cases following the 2012 derecho that left millions of people without electricity for days across much of the mid-Atlantic United States. The excessive high humidity and sweating led to an increase in moisture on the patient's skin. Without power, it was difficult for caregivers to keep them clean and dry because of the lack of air conditioning and heated water. Both patients later died, and their situations during the power outage were believed to have played a role. Nitsch says without power, caregivers are handcuffed.
Makes it really difficult because our patients, it was a matter of what they were lying on. But for other patients, it's oxygen, it's nebulizer machines, it's any number of other suction machines, for example, other kinds of things that require electrical power.
Nitsch and her team of researchers say their studies show the need for continuous power service for bedridden patients and overall awareness of opportunities for elderly when outages occur. Nitsch says most power companies offer a high priority restoration status, but documentation must be completed with the assistance of healthcare providers. She says even then, depending on the situation, having a high priority restoration status is not a guarantee that the power will be back on anytime soon. Nitsch says more elderly need to make use of the 211 call center system and the Vulnerable Needs Registry. The 211 system will allow the elderly and their caregivers to locate services that are needed. Nitsch says it comes down to a need for better coordination of services.
My hope for the larger community is that people who are doing some really good and some really hard work out there trying to make us all better prepared for this can start talking to each other, because there's no need in reinventing wheels, and there's no need in services being there that are not utilized simply because people don't know about them.
The Vulnerable Needs Registry, available in 9 West Virginia counties, requires a survey to be completed for the patient and make sure there is a record of what the patient needs when an emergency occurs. Nitsch says she just hopes this brings more attention to something that is near and dear to the hearts of many.
Individuals will have prepared and will have begun to recognize that while they think they might be ready, if they really thought about it specifically, maybe they're not ready, so that they can get themselves ready.
The study notes that the Vulnerable Needs Registry is only available in Cabell, Boone, Jackson, Lincoln, Logan, Mason, Mingo, Putnam, and Wayne counties, unlike the 211 call center system, which is available nationwide. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Clark Davis in Huntington.
This is West Virginia Morning at 7:38. Mostly sunny and cold today with temperatures only in the teens and 20s. It'll feel a lot colder because it'll be windy with gusts of up to 35 miles per hour. Mostly clear and cold overnight, mostly sunny and a little warmer tomorrow.
Support provided by the West Virginia Division of Rehabilitation Services, enabling and empowering workers with disabilities to meet business workforce needs. Visit wvdrs.org for employer services.
Tucker County clock repairman Doyle Kistner is celebrating his 90th birthday today, and he's seen a lot of changes since 1923. For the past 2.5 years, Jessica Collar has been his apprentice and caretaker. Traveling 219 reporter Roxy Todd began visiting the pair in the clock workshop shortly after Jessica began working with Doyle.
Over the next 20 years, most people who still know the art of clock repair will pass away, leaving the world millions of antique clocks in need of regular winding and repair. But in Tucker County, West Virginia, Jessica Collar, a young woman in her 30s, is learning the art of clock repair from 89-year-old Doyle Kistner.
There could be this side. 1, 2, 3. Oh, you got that right. That's all due. Still plays all these tunes out. it'll strike over here, I see.
I'm learning something that nobody else probably will.
Jessica first met Doyle a few years ago while he was recovering from cancer treatments. She began working with Doyle as an in-home caretaker with the Tucker County Senior Center. When she learned that Doyle was a talented clock repairman and clockmaker, Jessica urged him to start working at it every day. Little by little, Doyle started to get stronger, and meanwhile, Jessica was learning clock repair.
He was fighting cancer. He had cancer in his prostate. Whenever I came to Doyle, he was skinny and frail, and he wouldn't talk. Now it's just like I'm part of the family, kind of.
She brought me alive, so that's one good thing I can say about her.
Well, that wasn't me, though. That was God.
Down in the basement, Doyle and his apprentice are seated while they work, amidst the chimes of cuckoo clocks and the discordant clash of gongs and bells. Jessica has a small, delicate chain between her fingers. For a few minutes, she's been easing it into an old grandfather clock. Attached to the chain hang the weights that strike the clock's hourly chime. She's giving the old clock its voice back.
You get interested, you don't know what time it is. Time goes so fast. First thing you know, it's 12 o'clock, it's bedtime. You never didn't even know it. That is when you're doing something that you like to do. See, that's the sound.
Doyle remembers the first clock that ever fascinated him. When he was in the 8th or 9th grade, his family was too poor for the kids to get an allowance. And so during the noon hour, while a lot of the other kids would head out to the general stores in downtown Parsons to buy sweets, Doyle usually passed a lot of his time looking in all the windows alone. One day, as he was looking through one of the windows, he caught a glimpse of an anniversary clock, a very small silver clock with a clear glass dome over the top.
The first clock I remember went around and around. You wind it for once a year on your anniversary. It's all running, one whole year.
It's been over 100 years since Doyle's dad bought the family farm here in 1912. The entire land was covered with forest, and Doyle's parents cleared the land themselves, blasting stumps and hauling the timber out with horses.
Parsons back then, there was a lot of things going on then. I said we had a great fair, and it was right there in Parsons. We were all raised on this farm right here, this farm. You know, we were poor.
Doyle lost his right hand in a farming accident in 1983. Determined to show everyone, including himself, that he wasn't handicapped, Doyle began fixing clocks. He took a special interest in the old broken clocks that other people wanted to throw away. The hobby helped him grow stronger, and it gave him confidence as he learned to live without his right hand.
And he had to learn everything over with his left hand.
It didn't bother me anything. I knew it was bad, but I had to accept it. So, you know, I used to cry over it. It's the way you take it.
Yeah, it's not what you got, it's what you do with it.
Yeah, I can't sit still. I got to figure out everything. I never go to sleep between 3 and 4 o'clock every morning because I got things on my mind.
Well, I got 10, 11, 12, 13, 14 clocks, 14.
Today, 15. Doyle is nearing 90 years old. He's been an airplane mechanic, a farm manager, a beekeeper, and he's repaired over 1,300 clocks. Time is what you make of it, I think, considering what Doyle has filled into his 89 years. The air fills with the sounds of 300 antique clocks in Doyle's workshop, marking the slow, steady passage of time.
I got 10 down there right now to work on.
You're the one, you're my shining
happy birthday. 90 years old today, Doyle Kistner. This story was produced by Roxy Todd and the Traveling 219 Project, a production of Allegheny Mountain Radio with support from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the West Virginia Humanities Council, and AmeriCorps Vista. For more information, visit traveling219.com. The traditional Christmas song, Angels We Have Heard on High, as interpreted by noted jazz pianist Bob Thompson. Thompson and his band present their annual concert, Joy to the World, in three West Virginia cities this week. Traditional Christmas music, while certainly not written with a jazz arrangement in mind, these melodies lend themselves well to jazz, do they?
Yes, I think so. I really feel that way. And, you know, you have to be very careful when you're dealing with Christmas music, because this is music that belongs to everybody, and people know this music, and it's special to them. So you can't take it too far away from what it is, and because that's what you want. You want to still evoke those memories of the holidays, you know, with people. So you can't get too far outside. But at the same time, we try to put our own stamp on it.
Bob Thompson sat down with us to talk about his music. When did little Bobby Thompson learn to play the piano?
Oh, my. Well, actually, when I was real young, I took a few lessons. And I had a great teacher who came to my house. And, you know, we always had a piano around. And I didn't do too well. But he thought, well, maybe there's something there. So one summer, he told my mother he wanted to give me lessons for free over the summer. And I said, no, I just raised, you know, a fit.
Yeah.
I can't take up my whole summer taking piano lessons. And so I didn't get back to the piano until I got in college, because I was playing the trumpet in the high school bands and things like that. So I was always playing something.
Mm-hmm.
But in fact, I was a trumpet major when I was at West Virginia State. And then I started playing piano around the campus and, a little jazz band and things like that. And that's when I found out that the piano was my home, you know, because I really, once I started playing jazz on the piano, then I realized this is what I really want to do.
About what year would this have been?
Oh, 1961 or 62, something like that.
Oh, when jazz was really big.
But those were great
times.
Those
were great jazz days.
Yes. In fact, all over the world, we had opportunity to go to Algiers, and then we went through Rome, Geneva, Paris, London, and we're fortunate to be in Paris for a little while, and that's when jazz was king over there.
Yeah.
If you were an American, African-American jazz player in Paris during that time, you know.
Heady days.
Yeah.
Heady days.
Great times.
Now, you grew up in Charleston?
I grew up in New York.
You did?
Yes, I grew up in Jamaica, Queens,
okay.
New York City.
All right. How'd you get to West Virginia?
I came here to go to West Virginia State.
Okay.
Yeah. At that time, there was a big alumni association in New York City. And every year they gave a scholarship to New York City student to come to state. So that's how I got here. I thought, well, I'd go down there and stay for a year and do that and then come back and go to school in New York. And once I got here, the first year, I have to say, I was like, where am I? What have I done? But then now I wouldn't trade it for anything. I really enjoy being here.
And you find West Virginia is an okay place for jazz?
Yes, I have found it to be so. I was fortunate to be able to learn here. And it was only because people came out to hear us play, when we were just beginning. And so that gave us opportunities to play, and that's how I learned, which I may not have had those opportunities in other places, where you have to really be great before anybody will even take notice of you. But so I received a lot of support here, and I find that music audiences here like lots of different things. So they'll come to a jazz performance and they'll be listening to bluegrass the next night or the symphony orchestra the following night. So, people are really versatile in their musical tastes here.
Bob Thompson, thank you very much.
All right, thank you, Beth.
Bob Thompson is also with the Mountain Stage Band. Joy to the World, Thompson and his band's annual Christmas gift to jazz lovers, will be presented in three cities, beginning tonight at the Culture Center in Charleston, Friday night at Davis and Elkins College in Elkins, and Saturday night at the WVU Creative Arts Center in Morgantown. For more information, visit our website, wvpublic.org. West Virginia Morning is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, which is solely responsible for its content. I'm Beth Voorhees.